Chapter 13 Shadow and Sound. The stillness deepened. It seemed to me that I could hear the quickening beat of the pulse of my heart. A sort of vague terror began to possess me. I fought against its insidious influence. Bending my head down over the paper I had set out before me, I prepared to write. After a few minutes, I managed to gain some control over my nerves and started. Though I knew there was little danger of my ever forgetting them, to set down clearly and in sequence the things Aselzion had told me. Then, a sudden sensation came over me, which forced on me the impression that something, or someone, was in the room looking at me steadfastly. With an effort, I raised my head. I saw nothing at first, but by degrees I became aware that a shadow, dark and impenetrable, stood between me and the open window. At first the shadow seemed merely a formless mass of vapor, but very gradually it assumed the outline of a shape that did not seem human. I laid down my pen, my heart thumping with hammer strokes of fear, and looked at this strange darkness as it gathered together, blocking out the silver gleam of the moon. Suddenly all the light in my room was extinguished. A cry rose involuntarily to my lips. Physical fright began to gain mastery over me. With the increasing gloom, the mysterious shadow slowly gained in definition. A patch of blackness stood out against the darkness. The pale glint of the moonbeams faintly illumined the form, as a cloud may be edged with a suggestion of light. The figure was not motionless. It stirred occasionally, as if about to raise itself to some great height and bend over me, or swoop down upon me like a dark eagle. As I continued to gaze upon it fearfully, my every nerve strained to a point of almost unbearable tension. I could have sworn that two eyes, large and luminous, were fixed on mine with a searching, pitiless intensity. It is impossible to describe what I felt. A sense of swooning horror overcame me. My head swam giddily, and I could not utter a word nor even a sound. Trembling violently, I rose to my feet, as a kind of mechanical impulse, determined to turn away from this terrible phantom. Then suddenly, the thought came to me as if by a lightning flash of conviction, that not by cowardly avoidance could I expect to overcome either my own fears or the nameless danger threatening me. I closed my eyes and retreated, as it were, into myself, to find that center of my spirit which I knew was invincible to all attack, being itself immortal. Mentally, I barricaded my soul with thoughts of fierce resistance. Then, opening my eyes again, I saw that the shadow loomed blacker and vaster, while the luminance around it was more defined and was not the radiance of the moon, but some other light, ghostly and terrifying. Now, however, I had regained a little of my courage, and, slight as it was, I held to it as my last hope. Gradually I steadied myself in that thought of courage, like a drowning creature clinging to a plank and waiting for rescue. I found myself able, presently, to ask questions of my inner consciousness. What, after all, could this phantom, if such indeed it were, do to harm me? Could it kill me by sheer terror? Surely in that case I would be at fault. For what was there really to fear? Death itself was no more than a change. Did it matter so much in what that change consisted? I had lived a good life. If I died or changed, surely the change could not be detrimental to me. Who, I asked myself, is responsible for this fear? Who is it that so mistrusts the divine order of the universe as to doubt the ultimate goodness in things, even if at present they appear evil? Am not I alone, the instigator of this dread? And can this dark, dumb specter do more to me than is ordained for my blessing in the end? With these thoughts I grew bold. My nervous trembling ceased. I now chose deliberately to consider and willed to look upon this mysterious shadow growing ever darker as something of a friend in disguise. I lifted my head half defiantly and half hopefully to the gloom. The strange fact that the only light I saw came from the weirdly gleaming edge of radiance around the phantom itself did not frighten me away from the attitude on which I had resolved. The more I grounded myself in this attitude, the firmer my courage became. I gently moved the table on which I had been writing and stood up. Once on my feet, I felt bolder still and more sure of myself. And though the shadow before me looked darker and more threatening than ever, I began to move steadily toward it. I made an effort to speak to it, and at last I found my voice. "Whatever you are," I said aloud, "you cannot even exist without God's will. He ordains nothing that is not for good. Therefore you cannot be here with any evil purpose. If I am afraid of you, my fear is my weakness. I will not look at you as having any harmful intent. Therefore I am coming to you to discover your true meaning. You shall prove to me what you are made of, to the very depth and heart of your darkness. You shall unveil to me all that you hide behind that terrifying aspect. I know that, whatever your intention towards me, you cannot harm my soul." As I spoke, I drew ever nearer. The luminous edge around the phantom began to lighten. Suddenly a flash of brilliant rainbow color glittered full into my eyes, so brightly that I fell back, half blinded by the splendor. Then, as I continued to look, I dropped to my knees in speechless awe, for the shadow had changed into a dazzling shape of winged radiance, a face and figure so glorious that I gazed and gazed at it, my entire soul entranced in wonder. Delicious music sounded around me, yet I could hardly listen to it, for my whole soul was in my eyes. The vision grew in stature and in splendor. I stretched out my hands to it in prayerful appeal, conscious that I was in the shining presence of some inhabitant of higher and more ethereal spheres than our own. The beautiful head, crowned with a diadem of flowers like white stars, bent towards me. The luminous eyes smiled into mine, and a voice sweeter than all sweet singing spoke to me in accents of thrilling tenderness. "Thou hast done well," it said. "Even so, always approach darkness without fear. Then shalt thou find the light. Meet sorrow with a trusting heart. So shalt thou discover an angel in disguise. God thinks no evil of thee, desires no wrong towards thee, has no punishment in store for thee. Give thyself into his hand and be at peace." Slowly, like the colors of the sunset melting away into the gray of twilight, the vision faded. And when I recovered from the dazzled bewilderment into which I had fallen, I found myself again in complete solitude and darkness, a darkness unrelieved, saved by the dim light of the setting moon. For a long time I was unable to think of anything but the strange experience through which I had just passed. And I wondered what would have been the consequence if, instead of boldly advancing and confronting the dark, terrifying phantom, I had striven to escape. I believed, and I think I was right in my belief, that I should have found every door open and every facility offered me for a cowardly retreat, had I chosen to make one. And then, everything would have been at an end. I should probably have had to leave the house of Aselzion. And perhaps I too should have been marked with the black cross as a failure. Inwardly I rejoiced that, so far, I had not given way. Presently, yielding to a drowsiness that now began to steal over me, I undressed and went to bed, perfectly tranquil in mind and happy. I must have slept for several hours when I was awakened suddenly by the sound of voices conversing quite close to me. In fact, they seemed to be on the other side of the wall against which my bed was placed. They were men's voices, and one or two of them sounded curiously harsh and irritable. There was plenty of light in the room, for the night had passed, and as far as I could tell, it was early morning. The voices went on, and I found myself compelled to listen to them.
"Aselzion is the cleverest humbug of his time," said one. "He is never so happy as when he can play the little god and dupe his worshippers."
A laugh followed this sentence.
"He's a marvel in his way," said another. "He must be a descendant of some Egyptian conjurer. There is nothing in the line of so-called miracles that he cannot do. And of course, those who are ignorant of his methods and who are credulous themselves..."
"Like that woman here," interposed another.
"Yes, like that woman here, little fool."
And there was more laughter. I sat up in bed, straining my ears now for every word. My cheeks were burning, my heart beating. I hardly knew what to think. There was silence for 2 or 3 minutes. Minutes that, in my longing to hear more, seemed to stretch out for ages.
"Santorus always manages to amuse himself," said a thin, sharp voice with a mocking ring in it. "There has always been some woman or another in love with him, and some women he could take in very, very easily, of course. Not difficult to find them. Most women are blind where their affections are concerned, or their vanity."
Another silence. I rose from my bed, shivering with a sense of sudden cold, and threw on my dressing gown. Going to the window, I looked out onto the fair expanse of calm sea, silver gray in the early dawn. How still and peaceful it looked. What a contrast to the storm of doubt and terror raging in my heart. "Hush! The voices again."
"Well, what would you? Some people, women especially, like to fool themselves that there's a god. Should be obvious to everyone, with all the blunders in evolution, that no god could have made this universe. Isn't it impious of people to impute such fumblings to a divine being?"
The first laughed cynically.
"Divine? As divine as your local butcher, if you ask me. Look at all the suffering he's caused. If that's a loving god, I'll take the Spanish Inquisition."
"Yes," I thought. "If God loves man, how could he cause so much pain?" As if in answer to this thought, a voice laughed.
"Think of all the helpless babies born deformed."
Another voice rejoined.
"And all the innocent people left writhing in agony with the plague."
I drew myself away from the wall, trembling. Mechanically, I dressed myself and stared out at the gold of the sun, which now poured its radiance full on the sea. The beauty of the scene moved me not at all. Nothing mattered. All that my consciousness could take in was that there were sound reasons for dismissing as a callous butcher the god I sought with so much love. "It's wicked," I cried silently, "wicked that God should throw us out onto this planet, teeming with horrors, and allow us to imagine that this world is beautiful. Why, beauty and divine justice simply don't exist. It is cruel to tell us to love and then give us only disappointment and treachery." All at once I remembered the dark phantom of the night and its transformation into the vision of an angel. I had struggled against the terror of its spectral appearance and had conquered my fears. Why was I now shaken from my self-control? What was the cause? Voices, merely. Voices behind a wall, speaking of death and betrayal. Voices belonging to persons I didn't know and could not see. Voices of the world, I reflected, which delight in uttering scandals and cruelties and never praise anything so enthusiastically as they offer condemnation. Voices merely? And who were the persons behind those voices, if persons they were at all, talking so callously? I had met no one in the house of Aselzion, save Aselzion himself and his disciple Honorius. Who but these two could know the reasons that had brought me here? Yet, with my bravest efforts, I could not recover myself sufficiently to be quite at peace. And in my restless condition of mind, I looked towards the turret door opening onto the stairway that led down to the little garden and the seashore below. But the door was fast shut, and I remembered Aselzion had locked it. Now, however, to my complete surprise, another door stood open, a door that had seemed to be part of the wall. Beyond it was disclosed a small room, a kind of little shrine, hung with pale purple silk, and looking as though it were intended to hold something valuable. I entered, hesitatingly, unsure whether I was doing right or wrong, yet impelled by more than curiosity. I saw in the small room which I had entered without really thinking, an exquisite little table, seemingly made of crystal and shining like a diamond. On the table lay an open book. A chair was placed in position for the evident purpose of reading, and as I approached, at first indifferently, then with awakening interest, I saw that the open book had an inscription on the flyleaf, "To a faithful student," from Aselzion. Was I that faithful student? I asked myself the question, doubtingly. What faithfulness was there in fears and depression? Here was I, shaken a little from my self-control by merely hearing voices behind a wall. I, who had said, "God ordains nothing that is not for good," was ready to listen to the worst blasphemy. I, to whom had been given the vision of an angel who had said to me, "God thinks no evil of thee, desires no wrong towards thee, has no punishment in store for thee. Give thyself into his hand and be at peace." I was already flinching and turning away from the faith that should be keeping me strong. A sense of shame stole over me. Almost timidly, I approached the table on which was the open book and sat in the chair placed there so invitingly. I read quietly, in a stillness made suddenly fragrant with the scent of unseen flowers.